Hello and welcome, everyone, to this teleconference on enhancing rigor and reproducibility in the reporting of agricultural, forestry, and nutrition research. This teleconference is being jointly conducted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Office of the Chief Scientist and the National Agriculture Library. And let me just first of all thank my USDA colleagues, Paul Laster, who's the director of the National Ag Library, Michelle Esch, Kristen Mitchell, and Al Karansky for their invaluable assistance in organizing this teleconference. And most of them are on the call today. As many of you know through articles in Science, Nature, and other scientific publications, as well as through reports in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and other news media outlets, there's been growing concern about the reproducibility of published research results. Such concerns have been raised with research across scientific disciplines, including research areas in psychology, which is probably one of the areas that received quite a bit of attention early on. But also in recent years, we've seen difficulties in trying to replicate cancer studies. And this past year, there's been quite a bit of focus on the ability to reproduce nutrition research. And this is due at least in part to the release of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans that was released jointly by USDA and the Department of Health and Human Services. So it really is an issue that cuts across research disciplines. And as you may know, efforts are underway across federal agencies to address these concerns as they pertain to the research in their portfolios. In addition, there's been efforts by journals and scientific societies recognizing the importance of this issue and the roles that the journals and societies can play in fostering rigor and reproducibility. And as a recent example, some of you may be aware that in 2014, Science, Nature Publishing, and the NIH did convene a meeting of journal editors involving 30 basic preclinical science journals, which were among the top journals in which NIH-funded investigators published. And as a result of that workshop, a consensus set of principles and guidelines for reporting preclinical research was adopted. And in fact, it's my understanding that as of today, over 70 scientific journals and societies have now endorsed that consensus set of principles. We'll be hearing more about that from one of our speakers later in the session, and a copy of those principles were provided ahead of time, as well as a link in the agenda. So today, USDA is convening this teleconference specifically to engage on this topic with agriculture, forestry, and nutrition research with the editors and journals that publish in those areas, as well as the scientific societies and associations that promote such research. I'm pleased to announce that as of this morning, we had 92 individuals who had registered for the call, representing over 60 journals and scientific societies that are either involved in or promote research across the myriad of domains in which within agriculture, forestry, and nutrition research. So today we're going to hear some introductory remarks on a recent advisory report that USDA received with regard to how we can increase rigor and reproducibility with the research within our portfolio. We're then going to hear from Dr. Paul Laster on recent USDA open data efforts to helpfully enhance dissemination of information and transparency of the research that USDA is involved with. We're going to hear really some really novel concepts and ideas from the Center for Open Science on efforts and initiatives that they have underway. We'll then hear from a speaker from the NIH, Dr. Tara Schwetz, who's been involved with the principles and guidelines that I referenced, these consensus guidelines for reporting research. We'll then hear about some ongoing efforts or proposed efforts from scientific societies. And then for the last part of the session, we will have an open discussion centered around the questions at the that were provided in the agenda that was circulated ahead of time. So I want to thank you again for your participation in this really important topic that I think that we all have a vested interest in, whether it's not as a funding agency, as the scientists who conduct the research, and or the individuals who rely on the information and publish it. So for a few more introductory remarks at this point and some more background information on why this conference is being convened, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ann Bartuska, who is the Acting Undersecretary for Research Education and Economics.
Doug, thank you, and welcome to all of you. Very pleased to have you be part of this teleconference on enhancing rigor and reproducibility for ag, forestry, and nutrition research. And I'd have to say a word on behalf of our previous Undersecretary, Dr. Catherine Lotecki, who just recently retired. This was something that she really had pushed very hard to put in place, and it was the one thing she regretted as she left a little early from the Undersecretary role, but it, because we do feel that it's such an important thing for us to be considering. I think most of you know that USDA has a very heavy research portfolio, both in its intramural research organizations, ARS and Forest Service, Economic Research Service, where we are actually have staff and scientists who are doing research, and our extramural research programs that are funding universities and other institutions. And so the ability to address this issue of rigor and reproducibility in the whole scope of our science portfolio and both internal and external research funding is something that we really do see is important to be addressing. And not only because of the science that we do, but because the information that we produce from the research is really part of the decision-making and regulatory activities of the rest of USDA, and in fact our other agencies at USDA do rely on what we produce. So we clearly have a vested interest in the issues of rigor and reproducibility and the importance that those efforts carry on our mission within USDA. In recognition of the growing concern that had been broadly raised, and Dr. Bannerman mentioned several of the publications that had raised the issue as well as several different events that have taken place, we really aligned ourselves with other federal agencies such as National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation in evaluating and developing actions to enhance the rigor and reproducibility of the research that we conduct and support. In the spring of this year, our Undersecretary Catherine Lotecki charged one of our advisory bodies, the National Agricultural Research Extension Education and Economics Advisory Board, also called NARI, which I may reference it that way, just as easier. But the NARI board actually is critically important for us because it advises the Secretary of Agriculture on top priorities and policies for food and agricultural research, education, extension, and economics, as the name implies. And it's a standing body that really allows us a go-to place to have a group of those who understand the full scope of the work we do to evaluate different aspects of the doing of science and the science of science policy. In the fall of 2016, the advisory board issued a set of recommendations for the department to consider specifically around rigor and reproducibility in science. In addition to recommending specific actions that we could take, the advisory board clearly recognized the essential role that journals and their parent scientific organizations play in enhancing these aspects of research, and that they are critical partners with us within agencies to deliver on progress with regard to rigor and reproducibility. So consequently, the advisory board's report addressed certain or provided some holistic recommendations involving USDA engaging with the editors and leadership of leading journals and scientific societies that report on and promote agricultural, forestry, and nutrition research, hence the value of having this particular conference call. Specifically acting on these recommendations, we felt that having this at this time would be very appropriate. It's an opportunity for us to start the new year with, I think, a major emphasis on this aspect of science and science management, and we look forward to having further dialogue with you. So I'm going to turn it over now to Dr. Mark McClellan, Vice President of Research at Utah State University and Chair of the Advisory Board Subcommittee that developed the report, to talk a little bit more on the specific findings and recommendations of that report. So Mark, over to you, and again, welcome all of you to be on this call.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate the opportunity. My name is Mark McClellan. I'm a food scientist, member of the Institute of Food Technologists, and have been an avid publisher in my past. This report was submitted September 20th of 2016 and will now work its way through to the secretary and on out. But I'm going to review it very quickly here with understanding that there's a lot more details in the report as it comes out. The report focuses on the three core issues surrounding what's generally phrased as reproducibility and rigor. The first is reproducibility itself, and that is the ability to take an original data set, conduct a separate but identical approach, and come up with the exact same, if not near to same, conclusions. The second issue is replicability, that the ability to take and generate a new set of data using the same conditions and coming up with the very same conclusions. And the third is generalizability, the ability to take data and apply it to other fields, other more general contexts, and finding out whether the rigor of the design allows it to be applied as such. The report focused on six major points. It talks about factors involved in the problems around reproducibility, and it talks about special conditions that agricultural and natural resources type research, including nutritional research, might encounter with this. It also discusses solutions, approaches that one might think of. Talk through some of these. It discusses USDA's thinking in terms of actions and activities, and talks about the resources USDA should make available and be sure to guide individuals. Finally, it comes out with specific action items specifically for the Office of the Chief Scientist to act on. So the first issue is general contributing factors, if you would, that lead us to concerns regarding this issue. It talks about data dredging, the desire of scientists to somehow find solutions in their data or find impart understandings that a first run at the data might not get you at, and talks about the need for a priori focus on approach to data and the importance of efforts to make that happen. Emitting null results is a common expectation, and yet sponsors of data would find that of value equally, and that we must find ways to get to null results. Underpowering of studies is of particular concern, and the report points out the fact that we do need to have to go out appropriate power analysis and statistical strengths to experiments in order to ensure that studies have adequate power. Errors and the occasional lapse of not reporting technical errors, underspecified methods, methods that simply are inadequate to be able to be replicated. These are all issues that we feel are critical and must be addressed both by societies, publishers, and others as they step into this. Weak design and weak design execution are also critical issues. When we look at unique contributing factors outside of these that I've just walked through, we understand that when you get into human research, ecosystems research, and agricultural variabilities in general, it can be very challenging. And yet, I think we are asked over and over again to step up to that challenge and to ensure that our researchers have appropriate design and appropriate strength to make sure this happens. In relation to the unique contributing factors, our first specific recommendation to the chief scientist is to ensure that an adequate discussion and use of power analysis is conducted throughout USDA, both intramural and extramural, where appropriate in terms of studies, and to promote this as a good practice and best practices. We then got into specific proposed solutions. These solutions will not be foreign to anyone who has been related to this area of work. This is highly common. The first and foremost is open data access. And of course, we'll be talking more about that specifically. But it's very important for follow-on concerns regarding studies to be conducted in the focus of an open data set access. Pre-registration is something we strongly ask people to take a look at. The idea that trials and experiments should be pre-registered with a design and approach that all can be examined and looked at in light of an upcoming project proposal. Collaboration, cooperative data sharing agreements, we strongly suggest here that the chief scientists and the office of the chief scientists encourage bodies, specifically scientific societies, to really open up this dialogue about the richness and value of sharing data, which is a very challenging subject for those of us in the academy, where we're constantly struggling with individual achievement and the attention towards tenure, as well as obviously doing data, doing research, and producing data for the benefit of all sponsors. Automation of data, laboratory management information systems, et cetera, foregone expectation. Open methods, a sharing of methods. We really encourage the chief scientists to drive to a much more broader opening up of methods and sharing of approach and methods in experimental design. And this should be also pushed towards the extramural field of experimentation. Finally, and in a very rich and very potential area, opening up discussion about post-publication discussions and the feeling that journals have a very unique opportunity here to offer extraordinary opportunities to open up discussion and interaction regarding the value and richness of particularly sponsored research that has been published in a particular journal. And we encourage the chief scientists to execute listening sessions, discussion sessions like this one right here to discuss this as a potential future. Finally, reporting guidelines, where sponsors really need to be much more aggressive in expectation of what is expected in terms of reporting, and including a much broader array of potential documentation, such as institutional review board documents and approval processes, or rather submissions where they have discussed their IRB approval process. The fourth point that we were talking about in this report was looking specifically at NIFA and ARS and whether they should be highly proactive. And as one might guess, the subcommittee here, the advisory task force that was focused on this, was overwhelmingly saying positive that we need to be much more engaging here. Yes, there should be a much more aggressiveness on the both intramural and extramural to be engaged, to look at rigor and reproducibility. Expect and demand that to be discussed in any proposal and then discussed in any publication and data set that's coming back. The fifth area was a focus on USDA practices and resources. And of course, we found a lot of richness in the documents that USDA already has in hand. Our feeling was that these need to be far more aggressively educated about, both for intramural and extramural research, and guidance and reassurance, if you would, to those that are going to receive these funds, that there's an expectation that they meet these policy guidelines that USDA has in place. The final part of the document was specific actions that we requested of the Office of General Counsel. It fell into a set of four core areas. The first is dealing with publishers. And basically, this meeting is the first of that, where we expressed an urgent need for the discussion with publishers regarding the need for publication results, including null results, the need for standardized procedures and reporting guidelines, and the need for post-publication review and discussion. The second was urging the Office of the Chief Scientist to convene meetings with scientific societies, discussing the value and strength of open data access, open method sharing, and reporting guidelines. The third is the conducting open forums with a much more broader participation, including those of principal investigators, where the pros and cons and difficulties of addressing these recommendations can be more fully shared. And finally, a specific set of guidelines to the Office of the Chief Scientist, specifically recommending, one, data dredging to be recognized as clearly an unacceptable practice. Two, to establish appropriate statistical power as an automatic expectation of any proposed work, whether it be intramural or extramural. Three, that a fully transparent process of sharing specified methods in detail be designed, and these include adequate experimental design. And fourth, to explicitly include statisticians where appropriate as full co-principal investigators on studies that warrant this kind of detail. Again, I've gone through this very, very fast, but hopefully it's given you a flavor of the nature of the report. Doug?
Great. Thanks, Mark. And I think just so everyone knows, that report will be made public, and it will be on USDA's website. So I think that if anyone is interested in getting doing a deeper dive and looking at fleshing out the details, that will be available on USDA's website. And once it is available, I'm happy to send out a link to it to all the participants on the call today. I think what we'll do is, just to keep us on time for now, let's move on to the next speaker. We're going to have an open discussion at the end. So certainly if there's some specific questions for Mark on the NERI board's recommendations and the rationale for those, we can come back to that. But let's now go ahead and move on to our next speaker. That's Mr. Paul Wester. He is the director of the National Agriculture Library. And certainly from both the NERI board report and from other efforts underway across agencies, federal agencies, one of the big ways in which to tackle the rigor and reproducibility issues is through transparency. And what we're going to hear from now from Dr. Paul Wester is how USDA and its open data in efforts are getting at that issue of transparency. Paul?
All right. Thank you very much, Doug. As Doug said, I'm going to talk a little bit about some policy activities that relate to open data at USDA and are also applicable government-wide, as well as talk about some tools and techniques and platforms that we're developing at the National Agricultural Library on behalf of USDA to help the open data issue as it relates to the rigor and reproducibility issue that we're talking about this afternoon. As by way of background, the work that we're doing that relates to the policy piece for scholarly publications and digital scientific data comes from two Office of Science and Technology policy documents. The first is the one from February 22, 2013, entitled Increasing Access to the Results of Thoroughly Published Research. The second is from March 20th of 2014, Improving the Management of and Access to Scientific Collections. And the focus of those documents and the direction from OSTP was on figuring out how to develop plans and processes and procedures and eventually tools and techniques for making the data that is being generated in the federal government, funded by the federal government, open and accessible and usable for reuse, reproducibility, and a whole host of other kinds of needs within the research community. Coming out of the work from those directions that came from OSTP, USDA promulgated an implementation plan to increase public access to results of USDA-funded scientific research in November of 2014. That implementation plan had four parts that was focused, two general pieces that relate to data and to publications, and each of those parts had four areas of focus, one on policy development, another on business processes, procedures, and resources, a third related to information systems and automation and kind of the platforms that need to be developed to make the policies occur. And then the fourth area was focused on outreach, education, and training. What are the things do to reinforce the policies, encourage people to use the tools, and think differently about how to deal with this issue overall. So what we did on behalf of USDA through our work at NAL and within ARS is take a look at the plan, figure out how to develop the policies that relate to the scholarly publications piece and the digital science, digital scientific data piece. And as part of that effort, we reached out to a wide variety of stakeholders to get input on their views about how this should work. A lot of the information that relates to how this is to be done is found in the implementation plan. So from the rolling out of the implementation plan in November of 2014 to now, as I mentioned, there are two areas that have been the focus on the policy side. One is the scholarly publications policy, which has been vetted and approved by the Science Council within USDA, and we're in the process of translating it into a formal rulemaking that we will promulgate through the Federal Register for comment to cover both intramural and extramural research. So that piece is moving along in pretty good pace. The second piece on the policy side is the digital scientific data policy, and we're still in the midst of taking a look at the work that needs to be done to promulgate that policy. So that's going to be work that will be conducted through the rest of this fiscal year. I'm hoping to have a draft towards the end of fiscal year 2017 for review and hopefully promulgation early in fiscal year 2018. And essentially what these two pieces do, both for the scholarly publications and for the scientific data, is codify and put out the rules of the road for managing these types of information. So that's where we are with the policy piece. At the same time as the policy pieces were being developed coming out of the implementation plan, USDA and the National Agricultural Library developed two platforms to deal with the publications themselves and agricultural and nutrition and life sciences data that are relevant to the work that we do both within ARS and with extramural research and land grants and other cooperators that we work with around the country. So the one information system that we have developed and we launched it back in October of 2014 is PubAg, which is our system for making available peer-reviewed scholarly research in the agricultural sciences. And I'll give some information on how you can access some of this content at the end of my presentation, but we have developed that system, brought it online, and is available National Agricultural Library's website, and right now we have over 41,000 different full-text articles of peer-reviewed content that is available for research and review. We also have 1.5 million citations of peer-reviewed articles from all the major journals that relate to agricultural and life science research that can also be used. With the PubAg system, we've essentially got it into a kind of advanced pilot kind of stage, and we're in the process of developing better user interfaces and search capabilities so that it's more easily used by the research community. We're looking at ways to broaden the scope of the content that's available through PubAg. Right now, the focus of most of the full text content that we have is within the kind of the ARS realm of research, so we need to figure out and develop ways to broaden the scope of that content. Again, that gets to some of the training and outreach activities I mentioned earlier. There are a number of different activities that we're doing related to optimizing back-end processes to scale up the system so that we can be able to deal more effectively with larger numbers of full-text articles and be able to get those in and make them available more quickly. And the other thing that we're also doing is working with organizations like CHORUS to make public access to scholarly content happen more effectively in the context of other federal agencies that are doing similar work. The thing that we're also doing as it relates to PubAg is how to make the connections publications and the data happen more effectively. So the second platform or the technology automation piece that we're working on is called Ag Data Commons, which is a platform that we soft launched in May of 2015 and developed into a prototype version and released last October, in October 2015. And it's designed to support the scholarly research community and kind of the enterprise data community needs, the data.gov type needs that USDA has here in the department. It also has some technical capabilities that are a little bit more robust than PubAg has, but we're trying to figure out and develop ways to make those connections more effective, including having DOIs. We allocate DOIs for data that's published within the Ag Data Commons and are providing links between data that we have or references to data that we have in Ag Data Commons with full text articles that we had in PubAg, so making that link between the full text articles and the data related to the research is what we're doing with the Ag Data Commons piece. And then we're also working on bringing more data sets into Ag Data Commons, as well as more references to data in other repositories through Ag Data Commons. So Ag Data Commons serves two roles. One is a repository, but in some respects, almost more importantly, as a pointer to other repositories where data is located that is related to scientific research funded by USDA. So right now we have over 240 data sets that are recorded or within or made accessible through Ag Data Commons. And much like the PubAg system, most of the connections are with ARS research and research data, and we need to figure out how to broaden the audience for that tool on the data side. So among the different things that we're working on with Ag Data Commons going into the future, figuring out how to, in an automated way, harvest metadata so that we can more easily manage the content that we're bringing in to Ag Data Commons, developing collaborative efforts with other agencies that are using similar technologies to ours to gather this data and manage the metadata related to the materials that we're bringing into Ag Data Commons, developing guidance for data management plans within ARS and others who are doing research and need to have effective guidance on how to manage the data that they're creating in their research efforts so that we can better manage it and preserve it and make it available through Ag Data Commons and be able to link it effectively to the full text articles that we'll be maintaining in PubAg. And then developing training and outreach and other kinds of activities to bolster the understanding of Ag Data Commons and PubAg together and the power that they both can have in supporting the research mission of USDA and the extramural partners that we work with and fund through NIFA and other activities within USDA. So kind of what I talked about this afternoon related to the tools and platform piece and then the policy piece. I didn't go into too much related to the outreach and education and the kinds of changes in business processes and procedures and resources that are talked about within the implementation plan, but those kind of dovetail with this policy and tool piece. So some of the next step kinds of activities that we're focused on is working the policy development process to its complete conclusion and getting those policies for both publications and for data finalized and then promulgated through the Federal Register and have as an official policy of the department, not just for the research is done within USDA, but also for our extramural partners. And then secondly, work on developing both the Ag Data Commons and the PubAg system, moving them from prototype pilot systems to production systems that can deal with more volume of content that's being developed across the research enterprise and making that content available for scientific research ability to support the larger science mission. And then the other thing, which is more my problem than anyone else's problem, I suppose, is figuring out what the long-term strategies need to be for sustaining these tools and sustaining these policies over time as technology changes, as the needs and requirements of our different user communities expand. We need to figure out how to be able to support those activities, and that's one of the things that we'll be doing more of in the coming year and reaching out to different communities that have interest in our success, which include the land-grant community, the publishing community, the different professional societies, and figuring out how we can explain what we're doing, how we're doing it, how what we're doing can benefit the larger research enterprise, and how public access and open data is kind of central to being able to make rigor and reproducibility happen. So in conclusion, I would encourage folks to take a look at the National Agricultural Library's website, www.nal.usda.gov, and you can click on Data to get to our Ag Data Commons site, or you can click on Collections and click down on Pub Ag, and you can get a sense of where we are from a technological perspective with these two platforms that more or less are implementing the policies that we're in the process of developing simultaneously. And if you're interested in having more information from me and our staff about how things work more technically, we can do that offline in a separate conversation with different individuals. We do that on a pretty regular basis with folks who reach out to us at the library. So that concludes my remarks, and I just want to say again, thanks, Doug, for including us at NAL as part of this conversation.
Okay. Paul, thanks very much. Why don't we see if there's maybe two or three broad questions for Paul on NAL's efforts.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can now.
Okay, great. So this is Nick Grunwald. I'm the chair of the Publications Board with the American Phytopathological Society. I have a question about integration of these new resources with the National Agricultural Library. With, for example, existing databases such as Dryad or FigShare or GenBank, and how these resources will be linked.
So within the Ag Data Commons, the Ag Data Commons serves two roles. One, as a catalog of databases that are available elsewhere in the repositories that you described, as well as a repository itself for agricultural data, or life sciences, nutrition types of data. So unlike PubAg, which will be the repository for full-text research that's funded by USDA, Ag Data Commons will serve first and primarily as a catalog so that we know where this data is, because data can be more appropriately managed in some of the other databases and institutions that you've mentioned than it can be in Ag Data Commons. But it's important to USDA to know where the data resides that was funded by USDA, and the primary focus is the cataloging function. But there are some smaller areas of research where there aren't established repositories or databases where it would make more sense for Ag Data Commons to take over that responsibility. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that answers my question.
Yes, my name is Peter Kitanidis. I am professor at Stanford and editor of the Journal of Hydrology. First, I want to emphasize the importance of repositories of data and the fact that throughout the country and the world, this need is recognized. Universities provide these services. Also, journals, in a way, provide this service. You can deposit the data, and in a way, they will stay there forever. I think this is extremely important for everyone. First of all, for the researchers who do the work, and then they move on to other things. They can upload this data and not worry about them anymore, and also in terms of the transparency. So do you plan to use some of the existing services or centralize these services in a way? I mean, how are you going to handle it in terms of agricultural research?
So from the data perspective, we view Ag Data Commons primarily or in the first place as a catalog and pointer kind of system to be able to understand where data is that's related to USDA-funded agricultural research. So the first order of business with Ag Data Commons is that cataloging piece. The second piece is being able to use Ag Data Commons and develop it in such a way that it can be a repository for materials that would not otherwise be covered by other repositories in different fields that different of you represent on the phone today. So I'm in complete agreement that we need to figure out how to understand, I guess, from a policy perspective and a technology perspective, who's doing what and what kinds of tools we have available to make sure that this data is being preserved and preserved effectively for the length of time preserved to support the research mission. As far as other types of collaboration, one of the things that NAL does is participates in a number of different agricultural information professional groups and societies and collaboratives, and we're in contact with different universities about the different activities that they're involved in, and a lot of them are watching closely what we're doing to see if they can either partner with us or lend us some assistance in thinking creatively about the challenges that we're trying to deal with.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Mickey Parrish, and I'm the, one hat is I'm the Senior Science Advisor at the Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition and at FDA, but also I'm the President-elect of the International Association for Food Protection, which publishes the Journal of Food Protection and Food Protection Trends. One of the questions that I find it interesting that USDA is engaged in this entire conversation and applaud USDA's efforts to talk about, rigor and reproducibility, because it is a critical issue, especially in these days of predatory journals and some researchers potentially publishing questionable results. So I applaud your efforts. I would point out that on the first hat I'm wearing with FDA, that we have an internal work group now that's been working on this for the last probably 2 years, looking at public access, and would suggest, Doug, that perhaps it might be appropriate to have a discussion between FDA and USDA regarding efforts in. There might be some cross-pollination that could occur, because frankly it is a bit difficult to address this and provide the data in a public setting, especially when you're a regulatory agency and having to address all of the implications, legal ramifications from that. So applaud your efforts. Those of us at IAFP and the Journal of Food Protection certainly understand the incredible significance and importance of addressing these issues right now, and the potential for problems that do exist, and trying to make sure that we handle this before it becomes such a before it creates reduces the public's view of science even more than it already is. So thank you very much for your time.
Okay, great. Thank you for those questions. And we should, if there's still some questions, hopefully we'll have some time left over at the end during the discussion period. But I'm really excited to move on to our next speaker, Dr. Brian Nosek, who's the Executive Director for Center for Open Science. I actually had the pleasure of hearing Dr. Nosek speak about a year ago and hear about really some of the novel ideas that they're coming up for developing positive incentives to get individuals to engage in rigor and reproducibility. So at this point, let me turn it over to Dr. Nosek.
Thanks very much, Doug. I'm very pleased to be speaking with this group. Let me give a couple of minutes just as an overview of what the Center for Open Science is, and then I'll spend time on the incentive projects, as you mentioned. The Center for Open Science was founded in 2013, and it's a nonprofit technology company with a mission to increase openness, integrity, and reproducibility of research. And we have four primary activities. One is meta-science, where we do investigations of the scientific process itself. So last year we published a large replication study about in psychology, trying to reproduce 100 published findings and not succeeding at reproducing many of them and investigating why. Next Tuesday, we'll have the first results come out of the reproducibility project in cancer biology that's been going on. And so most of my week this week has been interviews with journalists about that. So that will be some additional news about another discipline where these challenges are real, which is true for all disciplines. A second area of practice is training. We offer free training services, in-person, online webinars for how to increase reproducibility, how to do transparent research, how to pre-register studies. A third area, which is our largest area, is infrastructure. We have a staff of about 75, and about two-thirds of our team is a software development team that builds the Open Science Framework. That's at osf.io, and that's all of our services are free, but it's a free scholarly commons for researchers to manage their projects. It serves as a repository for data, and it serves as a registration system for doing pre-registration or registering research for archiving, preservation, and otherwise. That tool researchers can use privately for their own labs and collaborations as a way to store and manage and maintain their data and materials, research, analyses, and then makes it very easy to make some of it publicly accessible. But the more critical piece of the OSF is related to the prior questions about Paul's presentation, which is it has an abstracted API in the middle where we connect to other services in the entire research lifecycle, including other repositories like Figshare, Dryad, Dataverse, and otherwise, so that while the OSF is a repository, it also links all of the repositories together. So, for example, if you are a journal editor and you want to recommend that your authors put their data somewhere and there isn't a specialized repository like GenBank for the kinds of research that they do, OSF can facilitate the identification and deposit of that in a variety of different repositories if they're not already using the OSF, for example. It also has the share service, which is metadata about all research events of any kind, data sets, publications, preprints, otherwise, into a single fire hose of all of those research events and then curation tools around it. So I'm going to follow up with Paul hearing what PubEgg and our data commons are doing because those are highly relevant to those services. But the fourth area of practice is on incentives. Researchers have the values of openness and transparency, but they aren't rewarded for doing them in the current way in which science operates. Right? The incentives for my success as a practicing researcher, I have a lab at the University of Virginia, is to focus on me getting it published, not on me getting it right. I need to publish as frequently as possible in the most prestigious outlets that I can in order to get my job, in order to keep my job, in order to advance in my career. And as we already discussed, and Mark gave a great overview of many of the challenges, not everything gets published, and there are certain kinds of results that are better for me, and there are things that I might do, selective reporting, data dredging, other activities that might increase publishability of those results while simultaneously reducing their accuracy and reproducibility. And so the goal of the incentive programs is to align what's good for me as a practicing researcher with what's good for science. And I'll give three examples of the kinds of incentives that we have been working on in the research community, primarily focused on journals and funders, because I know that's most of what the representation here is today. So one very simple incentive is badges. So we created these badges for open data, open materials, and pre-registration. And a committee of researchers in a variety of fields maintains the specifications for what does it mean to meet open data standards. Journals can offer these badges to their authors that once they've been accepted and say, would you like your article's going to appear? If you'd like this badge to appear on the article that says you have open data, you just have to meet these criteria, and then the badge appears with a link to where the data are. Now, badges, we might say, we don't need no stinking badges. What are badges for? This isn't Girl Scouts. But badges, when it signifies something that is already valued in the community, become signals. Right? It is important to me to be more transparent in my research. Open data is a good thing. So by having a very easy signal on the article that says there is open data and here is where you find it, that may encourage that behavior. And so we got the first journal to adopt badges, Psychological Science, the leading empirical outlet in my field, to adopt badges January 1st, 2014. In the 2 years prior to that, the proportion of articles that had open data was 3%. In that journal. In the first half of 2015, the year after adoption of badges, 39% of the articles had open data. And the only policy change was the option to earn badges in order to do this. And we had comparison journals that had no change in the same field. So a very simple intervention when there already are values for that particular behavior can be highly effective. So that's one example. A second example is called the TOP guidelines. This is Transparency and Openness Promotion Guidelines. They're at cos.io/top. And these are taking all of the different discussions and standards about what does it mean to be transparent or do open or reproducible research, and pulling them together into 8 particular standards that journals or funders can adopt to encourage or require their authors or grantees to be more open or reproducible in their research. So that includes data standards, it includes design transparency, data citation, what the policies about replication are for that journal. And each of those standards has 3 levels of stringency. So journals can decide, you know, my discipline isn't quite ready for full open data. So we will start at level 1, which is requiring that authors say whether or not the data are open, and if they are, where they are. So not requiring open data, but requiring disclosure of. Whereas level 2 is requiring that that data be open. And level 3 is not only do we require it be open, but we are going to have an independent team or reviewer get the data and see if they can reproduce the analyses that you report in the paper. Now that's a very high stringent requirement. It also is a resource investment as compared to level 2. So the use of levels for those different guidelines is meant to encourage adoption, but have flexibility for the fact that there are reality constraints for what journals can do and what different subdisciplines are ready to do. But they provide a framework promoting principles and standards and policies for open data and related parts of transparency. So far for that, we have something like 740 journals are signatories, and about 66 organizations are as well. And to be a signatory for the TOP guidelines is a very low bar. It means we are going to conduct a review. We're interested in transparency. We're going to conduct a review for adopting guidelines for our own practices. So that's one that's available. A third area of incentives is related to pre-registration. And that already has come up a bit in Mark's remarks. And the real goal of pre-registration is to make clear the distinction between confirmatory and exploratory research. Right? There are many times where we are in exploratory mode of analysis. Right? We are using data in order to generate new hypotheses, see what might be possible, exploring the data in order to learn from it. But we, in that mode of analysis, our statistical inference tests are non-diagnostic. Right? We are deliberately using the data to inform our hypotheses, and so the p-values lose their probative value. Whereas in context of justification, when we're in a confirmatory mode of analysis, we make decisions about testing a hypothesis independent of knowing what the data are, and so the data are used to confront that hypothesis. And so we have to make commitments in advance, constrain ourselves, so that those p-values and whatever tool inference have their diagnosticity. So pre-registration is important because it's so easy to mix up when we're in the process of doing our research, whether we are in discovery or confirmatory modes of analysis. And so we've been doing a few things, both in training to educate people about what pre-registration is, also in infrastructure, we provide tools for pre-registration, and in incentives. And there are 2 that I'll mention briefly before we stop. One is the Pre-Reg Challenge, where we are giving away $1,000 awards to the first researchers that publish the results of a pre-registered study. And the goal of this is as an awareness and education campaign. So people learn about what pre-registration is. We have a guided workflow that teaches them about what its purpose is, how it works, how to do it, gives them a workflow in order to pre-register their research. And if they publish in one of the eligible journals, which are members of the TOP guidelines, then they can earn the $1,000 award for having done that. And our presumption is that once researchers actually go through the process of pre-registration, because it is unfamiliar and people are uncertain, is this going to hamstring me in ways that I don't think is productive for my kind of research, that once they actually have some experience with it, it will become a habit. They'll see the value for even their own confidence and credibility of the research that they publish. Related to that, but which is an actual journal initiative, is called Registered Reports. And this is a publishing model that's complementary to the existing model where the results are known when review is done. With Registered Reports, the researcher submits to the journal for peer review the research question, background and justification, and the methodology. And then that's what's reviewed in the first stage to get in-principle acceptance. You haven't done the research yet. You don't know what the outcomes are. But we think both this is an important question, and the methodology you're using is a very effective test of that question. And so we will commit to publishing that if you show in the stage two review that you've done the research competently. But the critical part is that stage two review is the decisions are independent of the results. So this is to combat the bias against negative results and also reprioritize the focus on the quality of the question and the importance of the methodology rather than being results-driven types of publication decisions. So we have 42 journals so far that offer registered reports as an option for publishing in their journal. Nature Human Behavior just launched yesterday, and it announced adoption of this, and Royal Society Open Science just announced adoption across their 200 different disciplines they publish in. So that is an intriguing model that we now have a couple of years of experience in terms of its strengths and limits as a complement to the traditional model of publishing based on knowing what the research outcomes are. I've covered a bunch of different things here, so I will also summarize all of these and provide links and send that to Doug so that that can be circulated to everyone. And I'll just mention one very last thing, which is on top of the Open Science Framework, we build different services that groups can adopt for themselves and brand for their own organizations. So, for example, there's OSF preprints as a service that makes that facilitates groups starting to use preprints and advance preprints as a way to accelerate communication and get comments prior to submitting for publication. And there is a group that is going to use our service to launch AgriCive, based on Archive, but for agricultural sciences. That should be coming out in a few weeks. And we have another service, OSF Registries, that will do the same thing. So any organization or group that wants to start a registry service for their community will be able to do so on that. So I'll stop with that, and we'll be happy to answer questions now or later.
Great. Hey, thank you, Dr. Nosek. This is Doug again. I just want to make three quick points. One is for everyone on the call in the agenda, we have a link to the Center for Open Science's website where you can find a lot of the information that Dr. Nosek talked about. I'd also like to say, and this goes back to the idea of the transparency and openness promotion guidelines, when I was putting together this conference, quite a few scientific colleagues had come to me and said, well, you know, you don't understand. There's so many disciplines that are covered under the Ag, Forestry, and Nutrition header, and we all have individual needs. And, how are you going to be able to tackle reproducibility across these domains? We all have our sort of idiosyncrasies, if you will. And one of the things that draws me to these transparency, openness, promotion guidelines is the different levels within the guidelines that really provide a flexible framework to meet domain-specific needs. And then the second thing, and this is just an email I'd received, we were supposed to be joined by Dorothy Tetzlaff, who is the editor-in-chief of Hydrological Processes, and she had said that I could share this with you. When talking about NOLB results, she said their journal certainly recognizes the importance of null and negative results, and they encourage authors to submit such papers, but it's the external reviewers who have difficulties with such papers. And so I think what Dr. Nosek has talked about today about the idea of these registered reports, where you get, in essence, a tentative acceptance before the results are known, and then there's a secondary review afterwards, gets around that, is one way to get around that issue of the bias against null results. So before we open it, Dr. Nosek, do you want to just comment on any response to those two comments before we go to questions?
Well, I totally agree. So, yeah, we can go with questions. That was a great summary.
Okay. Thank you.
This is Peter Kitanidis again. When we talk about results, I would like to raise the issue that results come may mean different things, first of all. Results are the raw data, and usually we don't question those unless there has been a major methodological error or foul play. And then there is some analysis, such as they calculate statistics like coefficient of variation, R squared, T statistic, F statistic, etc. And the final step is where I think a lot of the problems are. Researchers are asked to interpret what it all means to the public and what are the practical consequences of the results. So they have to arrive at conclusions such as they go from, okay, the R squared is 82%. That means that with 82% certainty, we can say that coffee is good for you for a certain purpose. So as an example. So this is, it is the final step where often you get a conclusion that cannot be reproduced because others with a different set of data, more data, less data, may arrive at a different final conclusion. So I don't know if this is something worth discussing, but I have the feeling that this is the last step. It is the last step where many of the mistakes are made and much of the credibility is lost.
I think that's a great point. And in the registered reports model, as for an example, the interpretation part, as you described, that last stage is part of the second round of review. After the results are known, what is their interpretation of those results? So it doesn't itself address the potential for inflated interpretation or misinterpretation. That is still left to the for the reviewers at that point to say whether they think those are credible interpretations based on the results as they're reported. Really, what registered reports helps with are the first two items as you described them, potential problems in the data acquisition itself, or the conducting of the analyses and potential flexibility that people employ if they don't have to commit in advance for obtaining positive results in a sea of noise that they may actually be inflating their likelihood of false positives. If you can get those commitments in advance for what their statistical analyses will be, what they will report, then you can have greater confidence in the outcomes that then are still subject to those subjective interpretations as you describe it.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is Dennis Beer. I'm the editor of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and a number of the prior, part of the prior discussion has dealt with the tendency for individuals to want to report positive data, and I think the literature is now, you know, full of a variety of studies that makes that clear. And as you know, the editor of the AJCN, it's, you know, not only clear, it's almost daily and compelling. I don't think any nutritionist would want to actually ever say we didn't find anything. I think, and someone has alluded to the issue of post hoc investigator degrees of freedom, PHACing, and things of that sort, which makes the entire discussions of trial registration, you know, truly important, and in my mind is probably one of the principal rate limiting steps of making the literature more, you know, compelling than it is at the moment. I think one of the issues that we face in trial registration is the use of the word trial. And I applaud the NIH for setting up clinicaltrials.gov. I realize that there are something like more than 40,000 observational studies registered in clinicaltrials.gov, but the word trials is something that suggests to individuals that you had to do an interventional experiment. And you had to do it for some purpose, often, you know, inferred as statutory. That's not the reason the AJCN requires trial registration. We require it for transparency purposes. And I think it would benefit potentially all of us if the word trial and clinicaltrials.gov became clinicalstudies.gov or something like that. And I think in nutrition, where the vast bulk of the data are observational studies, it's imperative that we require mandatory registration of observational studies, and that's made clear. There are, you know, there's a the observational community, at least, you know, a good part of the ones that I deal with, you know, seem to be fighting that tooth and nail. The reason there is it is the pre-specification of analytical approaches, of the actual endpoints, et cetera. We can spend more time than we want to spend on this call on that. I think that one of the issues with the current registration is that there seems to be little stringency in policing, for want of a better word, the specificity of the primary endpoint. And I think there one could really benefit the, you know, the clinicalstudies.gov by holding people's feet to the fire about how specific their primary endpoints are. Frequently there are things like decrease the incidence of cancer. I mean, they're so general that you can't possibly determine or affect development when there are, you know, 40 different domains of development, or, you know, so, I mean, this is a real limitation, and I think that we need to do something about that. I think maybe we're going to get to reporting requirements and things later. We did discuss a bit about that, but it's very clear to me that we also, or the funding agencies also need to have some sort of policing function, for want of a, not being able to immediately think of a better word, because there are no penalties for not doing certain things. And, you know, for example, we have talked about data availability. There are certainly enough studies in the literature that show that authors who've even signed that they will make their data available to certain journals, when someone comes for it, they don't get it. So, you know, this is something that needs to be tackled, and I appreciate the efforts being made in that regard, but I don't, you know, it seems to me we have to have a very serious effort on the practical nature of doing that. For example, people have data in, you know, proprietary software that can't be accessed by someone else. So we have to have, you know, very good rules for precisely how the data are held, how they can be, you know, read by others, how they can be translated into systems that others can use, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, those are a number of excellent points. And on the latter one to start, the TOP guidelines has in their specifications anticipations of things about not being able to share data, right? It's sensitive clinical data, for example, or it's proprietary. And the requirements in the TOP guidelines that would be adopted as policies is that those need to be in the cover letter to the editor at the onset, right? So, yes, of course, there will be exceptions to data sharing, but the editor should be aware so that he or she can make a discretionary judgment. Is this reasonable? And am I still willing to consider this submission for publication in that context?
Relating but a lot of people have gotten around. Yeah, a lot of individuals. You know, there are, you know, various places where the confidentiality agreements, confidentiality, anonymization, et cetera, have been tackled. I guess my message here is only that some group needs to practically tackle these really important issues if we're ever going to get data sharing. Right now, there's an awful lot of, you know, lip service being paid to it rather than, you know, developing the means that it actually is going to happen.
Yeah, that's right. There's a lot of work yet to do there. And on your first point on registrations, the Open Science Framework's registry service is general, so it is not limited to trial registrations by any means. Mm-hmm. And it also allows the creation of different types of registration formats. So in particular subdisciplines, there may be specific things that need to be shared, right? If it's neuroimaging research, they may have a set of requirements of what it needs to be reported in order for it to be an effective registration, both on the endpoints and on the methodology. And so the system is flexible to be able to do that and have different types of registration formats depending on the discipline. So one possibility that you or any of the editors could do, we could talk in collaboration about a special issue or a trial, a pilot of registered reports to see if raising some awareness and education within your author community might be effective in getting some more education and engagement with pre-registration and with data sharing.
Okay, all right, thank you. Just to keep us, we've got a couple more presentations and a little bit of time for discussion. Let's move on, but again, Dr. Nosek, thank you very much. Once again, another very engaging presentation that I've had the privilege to listen to. We're going to now move on to Dr. Tara Schwetz, who's a senior advisor at the National Institutes of Health. And she was involved, has been involved with the principles and guidelines for reporting preclinical research. These are the guidelines that resulted from that 2014 workshop that I referenced at the beginning, at the opening, that was convened by NIH Science and Nature Publishing. And so she's going to provide an overview of these principles. And I think one of the reasons I was really excited to have Tara speak is that there's applicability of these guidelines. Journals have already endorsed these guidelines. So one, we may not necessarily have to reinvent the wheel in our domains. And secondly, to show that consensus is possible. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tara.
All right. Thanks, Doug, and thank you for inviting me to speak a bit about the principles and guidelines. So just for a little bit of background, in early 2014, Drs. Collins and Tabak, who are the NIH director and principal deputy director, respectively, they wrote a commentary in Nature about a lot of general principles surrounding rigor and reproducibility and the issues, and NIH plans to enhance reproducibility of our funded work. And sort of after some feedback from the community and discussions internally, one of the things that we decided to do was to hold a workshop with the publishers. So we decided to focus it on preclinical research because we figured there's sort of two different beasts that fall under sort of our domain of research, which is clinical research and the preclinical space. And decided to focus on preclinical research and held a workshop in almost 2.5 years in 2014 that was jointly run by Nature Publishing Group and Science, in addition to us, on rigor and reproducibility of research findings. And we invited journal editors representing over 30 basic and preclinical science journals in which our NIH-funded investigators have published the most frequently. And the workshop really focused on common opportunities, best practices, what can we do collectively to enhance rigor and further support research that is really robust, reproducible, transparent. There were lots of really good discussions that focused on, how much it's going to cost, the things that, we're talking about. Is this going to eat up a lot of the journal's time, effort, staff time, just general resources, what really should be focused on? And there were several suggestions, most of which are included in the final version of the principles and guidelines, which I'll get to in a second. What is going to be the impact of these guidelines, positive, negative, what are things that other folks are doing that we can, outside the publishing field, that can sort of be considered and should also maybe potentially have the opportunity to sort of capitalize on. And in the end, the journal editors did come to a consensus on a set of principles. And as Doug mentioned, I think he said it's over 70 journals. We like to say over 135 because if you break them all down, all the Nature journals, all the circulation journals, it's about 135 total. And they came to consensus on some ideas that are pretty broad in scope because, as was mentioned previously, there are a lot of different fields and communities within this preclinical space and their own unique needs, and we wanted to be sure that, you know, they were broad enough that they could be they could cover all of these fields, but also specific enough so they weren't just watery ideas. And I think that they how they were developed, it allows folks to sort of tailor make them to their field, so they can focus in on one or two or three of the things in particular or knock one of them out. Or it just provides a little bit of flexibility in order to make them more unique to their own needs of their fields. And so I don't really want to go through these, you know, sort of point by point because they were sent to you previously and you can look through them. But really quickly, the guidelines focused on the need for rigorous statistical analyses, and so that this should be included in publications, and ideally it would be great if the journals could have a mechanism to check the accuracy of the submissions. Transparency in reporting, which I know has come up in previous discussions today, but, you know, not limiting or putting generous limits on method sections, using checklists when appropriate. And then data and material sharing. And this one is basically just to encourage sharing of software, data, materials, and also recommend deposition of data sets into public repositories when it's available. Considering publication of refutations. So if the journal, encouraging the journals to have a policy stating that if they publish a paper and, you know, they're encouraged to accept refutations, I guess is what I should say. And then consider establishing best practice guidelines for a variety of things, but we've really focused in on antibodies, cell lines, and animals. Those seem sources of a lot of issues with rigor and reproducibility. So that generally is a quick, high-level overview of the process for the development of these guidelines and then the guidelines themselves. We'll say that we sort of put it out there to all the journals that were involved in this and then opened it up more broadly and invited people to sign on to the guidelines. And we're pretty pleased with the response rate that we got, and as I mentioned, depending on how you count them, 70 to 135 journals endorsed them. And we have also opened it up to allow others who want to tweak them just for their field to let us know, and we'll post them on our website so we can sort of keep a nice running tab, and it's all in one place of all these things. And we have, for example, posted the top guidelines there. I believe the Biophysical Society has also posted their. We've also posted their guidelines as well. So I guess at this point, I'll open up to questions, discussion.
Great. Thank you, Tara. One quick point of emphasis, and this is based on conversations Tara and I have had previously, is that. You know, I think that, you know, when you first look at the guidelines and you see them on the NIH website, you know, there might be a gut reaction, think, oh, well, this is only applicable to the biomedical, you know, arena. But I think, as Tara mentioned, they are very broadly written. Certainly, looking through the endorsers, I see the Journal of Wildlife Diseases, as one of the endorsers listed. They're not. It doesn't have to be a preclinical or biomedical research that can be an endorser. And also, just looking at some of the issues such as antibodies, certainly in the veterinary community, and as someone who used to do veterinary research myself and review papers, the idea that people think that, scientists think that you can just take an antibody that's been made against a human epitope, work in bovine or whatever agricultural relevant species you work is just not true. And so I do think there's a lot of value in these guidelines. Tara, can you just maybe sort of comment on that or pick up on that?
Yeah, so one of the other things I was going to say is that when these are developed, as you mentioned, they were developed to be more broadly because, again, the biomedical research community is very heterogeneous, so it's not one homogenous community. But they were developed with the intent that they would be flexible and that hopefully they would serve as a template to others. And as I mentioned, the Biophysical Society, for example, which is my home society, by the way, I'm a biophysicist, they took them and said, okay, we're going to use this as a starting point, and then we're going to tailor make them to our community and what will work best for us. They've done this and now applied them to their journal.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hello?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. Hi, my name is Steve Gallo. I'm from the American Institute of Biological Sciences. And first off, thank you all for this is a really interesting discussion so far. I just was wondering, not only in terms of this talk, but some of the other ones as well, requiring open data and more, generous limits or no limits for method sections and even pre-registrations in some situations. I wonder how some of these requirements interact with the peer review process itself in terms of reviewer load. Peer review has been kind of described in some instances as a system under stress, and I know loads on reviewers for reviewing throughout the year are increasing as more journals propagate and more people submit proposals to grant funding agencies. So I wonder, does there also not need to be a discussion about incentives in terms of reviewers and doing a good job? And because it seems like there's possibly an increased burden on them through giving them all this information, extra information, which they should be using to do a good job and doing a review, but it also takes more time. And so I just wonder if anyone has comments on that. Thanks.
So one thing that, will sort of get to your question, hopefully, is that we are going to be holding a follow-up to the original meeting. We're beginning to plan it now and hope that it will be able to be scheduled for sometime in the summer of 2017. And this will give us an opportunity to, discuss upon what has worked, what hasn't, again, sort of best practices learned. And I think that this reviewer piece is going to be one of them. And additionally, and I'll sort of nod to Brian, I was recently in Virginia for a meeting where this sort of came up quite a bit, this sort of interaction between the funders and the publishers, and are there ways to sort of build off of the review processes that each are conducting? And I don't know, Brian, if you want to talk more about that.
Sure, I can just briefly say, and I'm directly on that question, the model register reports has two interesting features addressing reviewer load. One is that journals and funders can partner on the review process because essentially it is the same process that is supposedly going on when you're deciding whether to give a grant to do the research is what register reports is. The research isn't done yet. And so there are a couple of pilot models that are in development between funders and journals that have similar content interests if they passes the initial stage of peer review, the funder funds it, the journal commits to publishing it. And everybody wins, right? It's a single review process. Everybody's more efficient. The time takes less. Nobody dislikes it from the different stakeholders in that process. Right. The second element is that the register reports model, having peer review in advance, actually so far, the data, we don't have enough data on this yet, but the early returns suggest that it reduces the serial nature of publishing that puts a huge demand on reviewers, right? The crummy papers that I submit for review, I get rejected by Journal A, Journal B, Journal C, Journal D, Journal E, Journal F finally gives in and publishes it, right? It's now taken up 5 editors' time and 20 different reviewers. With registered reports, the model is very focused on how do we improve your methodology so that it will be publishable. And that iterative process before the research has been done both improves the research and appears to reduce the overall reviewer load across the entire community, perhaps not at the single journal. So those are early indicators of some benefits for that process.
Great, thanks.
And the one thing I will say, too, about the review process, just sort of a plug, I guess, if you will, for one of the things that NIH has done to tackle sort of the rigor and reproducibility issues that we recently as in last January, a year ago now, revised our application instructions and review criteria to really incorporate and further highlight and stress the importance of rigor and reproducibility.
Okay. That's great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, this is Dennis Beer again from the AJCN. I had a couple of comments. The first is that several people have talked about the broad nature of the guidelines in the context of the diverse, you know, scientific community we're discussing. But my position is that the principles of the scientific method, you know, are the same whether you're in physics or nutrition. And we're talking about determining, you know, truth, so to speak. And the conditions for doing that are really no different. So I think, you know, having one set of guidelines which says this is the way you need to do things in order to convince people that you have a true scientific observation are the same. Several people have, or at least it's come up once or twice, that the various, you know, space limitations of reporting data or methods or things like that. I think that was true in the days of print journalism, but as I think everybody on the, you know, the call knows, most journals today, the journal of record is the electronic version, and when one links, you know, and what could be an essentially endless amount of electronic data to the electronic version, there are no longer any real limitations of, you know, space for, you know, reporting things, supplemental data of any kind. And the other, you know, brief thing I'd like to address is the use of reporting requirements, and which I think are essential. We now have, you know, Equator Network has a vast number of those, and I think it's imperative that people use them for reasons that some have already stated. In nutrition, it's particularly imperative because if one wants to do systematic reviews, some very good studies get tossed out because they don't have the essential data that allows them to be included in a systematic review, and that's what part of the reason for the reporting requirements. The other issue in reporting is the discussion of statistics, and here we have, you know, a whole array of issues that are, you know, perhaps, you know, unique to nutrition, but I don't think so. The very basic ones, such as the occurrence of p-values less than 0.05 by chance alone when one does a lot of observations, the need for potentially, you know, correcting for that. I think we also, if we're going to talk about the importance of results, and someone earlier, you know, addressed that, I mean, we have to start in demanding the inclusion of things beyond the p-value, such as the effect size the confidence limits of the effect size, the reporting of things like absolute risk instead of just relative risk. For human studies, the need to start incorporating the number needed to treat and the number needed to harm, or the conversely, the number needed to harm, because particularly in the public health arena, if 1,000 people need to undertake a dietary modification to help one, that's something which I think would be highly debatable among, you know, people who are trying to develop public policy guidelines. So there are many steps further, you know, in where we need to move on some of these efforts.
Okay, all right, thank you. Great discussion. I think just to keep us moving along, I'd like to we're going to turn it over to Dr. Patrick Stover from the American Society for Nutrition, who's going to just basically give a brief overview of that society's efforts to address rigor and reproducibility.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to participate in this webinar. So I'm going to speak specifically about an ongoing initiative at the American Society for Nutrition where we've established the Blue Ribbon Advisory Committee that's focused on ensuring trust in nutrition science. I'm not going to speak specifically about the role of our journals in the area of rigor and reproducibility, but as you've heard, our editor of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Denny Beer, is on the line and can be available for any questions around our publications. But just to give you a little bit of landscape of why we established this board, first of all, I think we all understand that food and nutrition impacts every American every day, and there are numerous advocates and stakeholders across the food system. I think we also know that nutrition research directly impacts all Americans, and nutrition research is absolutely essential to advance nutrition policies, programs, dietary guidance, all of which touch virtually every American every day. We also know that nutrition research, the research enterprise, includes scientists from academia, the private sector, and government sectors. And effective interactions among these sectors are absolutely essential for maximal impact of nutrition research that promotes healthy populations. We also know that nutrition-related chronic diseases are common, growing, and many can be prevented, but we need much more research in this area. Furthermore, when we look at the landscape, we know that there's increased attention and new initiatives around public-private partnerships, not only for funding all research, but especially in the areas of nutrition and agriculture research. So in order to have nutrition research really serve the public, we need trust among scientists, all the stakeholders from academia, the private and corporate sectors, the non-for-profit sectors, the public and policymakers. These are all essential if we're going to bring the very best science to bear to improve the food supply, dietary guidance, and nutrition-related behaviors. But the ASN board was very concerned about the current state of trust in research in general, and specifically in nutrition research, especially research that cuts across academia, the public sector, and government. And some of this was referred to very early on about articles that have come out the past couple years in the New York Times. So last year, ASN started this initiative focused on ensuring trust in nutrition science, put together a Blue Ribbon Advisory Committee that included Cuthberto Garza as chair, who is currently director of the Food and Nutrition Board. It includes Vinita Bali, who is chair of the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition, Catherine Pertini, who is Professor of Public Administration and International Affairs with a lot of history of nutrition policy and programs in the United Nations, Eric Campbell, who is Professor of Medicine at Harvard, Ed Cooney, who is former Executive Director of the Congressional Hunger Center, Michael McGinnis, who is Executive Director of the National Academy of Medicine, Sylvia Rowe, who is President of SR Strategy LLC and an expert in communications, Robert Steinbrook, who is a professor of internal medicine at the Yale School of Medicine and is also editor of JAMA Internal Medicine, Carol Tucker Foreman, who is a distinguished fellow of the Consumer Federation of America Food Policy Institute, And finally, Kathy Witecki, who just stepped down as Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics at the USDA. And the committee has the following charge. It is to establish recognized best practices that allow collaboration across industry, government, academia, the nonprofit, non-governmental organizations that can be applied to the field of nutrition, leading to the best science possible and attained with the highest level of rigor and transparency. The second goal is to make those best practices publicly available for all interested parties to reference and to publish this through a high-profile publication, to make specific recommendations for best practices to the American Society for Nutrition Board and other organizations within the field of nutrition. And we also hope that these best practices will assist the public in objectively evaluating the scientific rigor and transparency of nutrition research. So this is an ongoing effort. Currently, we are crafting the report in collaboration with the committee. And the committee has really identified five domains that are really essential in nutrition research to engender public trust. This includes the concept of public benefit, of scientific rigor, of transparency, objectivity, and equity in our research, of effective communication of research, including truthful communication and understandable communication, and issues of accountability, both adherence and what the principles of accountability are. So that we have systematically searched the literature in each one of these domains, and now are writing a report based on that evidence synthesis, which quite frankly is scant when you look at the actual scientific literature, and also using a snowballing approach to find other relevant literature that will be synthesized, and we're going to really look at what the evidence is with each one of those domains in terms of its role of ensuring public trust and how those domains interact to ensure public trust. And from there, we will generate then specific recommendations for the American Society for Nutrition. So that is an ongoing initiative. I really can't report directly on any of the findings to date, but stay tuned. We hope to roll out this report later in the spring.
Great. Thank you for providing that summary of ASN's efforts on this. Let me just, in the sake of time, let's move on to Dr. Kent Messer. He is on the call today as a representative of the Council for Agriculture, Science, and Technology. And he's going to provide a CAST perspective and perhaps a role the CAST could play in this arena going forward. Kent?
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be able to talk today and to be invited to this very interesting discussion. Let me take a quick moment to just go through my background and how I get there. Ultimately, I'm representing CAST, but I don't work for them. I'm actually a professor at the University of Delaware, an economist that does work in the nexus of agriculture and the environment. I have served as a chair of a CAST issue paper that recently came out on the process labeling of food and consumer behavior, the ag sector, and policy recommendations. Also, the background, I've served as a journal editor for Agricultural and Resource Economics Review, so bringing a little bit of an economics perspective to this dialogue, along with co-directing USDA's ERS-funded Center for Behavioral and Experimental Agro-Environmental Research that works with ERS on many of these same topics, but applying it to the world of evidence-based policy and the agro-environmental sector, thinking about randomized controlled trials, mentioning things about systematic reviews and struggling with replicability within the economics world, right? Because we certainly struggle with that, and I would say the other disciplines are ahead of economists in general, and our part of our CBEAR project is to kind of increase the value for rigor, increase the value for replicability, especially as we do RCTs and so forth. But I want to talk on behalf of CAST, and you know, again, it's probably valuable for me as a researcher and a previous journal to editor to speak there, because CAST is really a gathering of experts that looks at issues facing the agricultural community and tries to connect in agricultural research with industry and with a focus on government. And, you know, that certainly is not an easy task, right, and try to do it in a rigorous scientific manner and to provide, you know, some guidance. I'll read from the mission statement, CAST. Many of you guys know it already, but it's really a network of experts and assembles and interprets and communicates credible, balanced, science-based information to policymakers, the media, the private sector, and the public. So, again, it's a little bit different spin on the research that we are putting out as part of the academic community and researchers, but really trying to bring that broader perspective and light and to communicate those results in a meaningful, rigorous way. So I can talk about, as a previous a chair of a CAST issue paper, what that meant and what that, you know, how CAST goes about selecting its topics. And first, the ideas come up, you know, from a variety of sources on what an issue paper should be, and then it immediately goes through multiple layers of review, from a work group that reviews, modifies before approval, and a board of directors of CAST again reviewing and approving it before a task force chair is ever, you know, brought on. And most of those task force chairs are volunteers within the academic community who, you know, are experts in a certain topic area that have been selected as having an area of expertise. And then the chair, in coordination with CAST, reaches out and assembles a task force team, often multidisciplinary in nature across agricultural topics, and ultimately develops a proposal to address many of the issues that were kind of brought up as an important topic for an issue paper. That has a semi-relationship to a journal in the sense that it does go through peer review, and the authors have an opportunity to respond and get feedback from it. There wouldn't be an editor who would make a final decision, and that's a slightly different process there, but certainly goes through, you know, a four-person task force, a four-person plus a review, and so there's lots of eyes on it. I think the one thing I think is important to talk about, especially in the agricultural sector and trying to link in industry and research and a focus on government, is the independence of the academics working on these issue papers, that that CAST provides a strong, you know, firewall, so to speak, of what you know, people might want them to say to what actually can get said, and the researchers who lead the project get to say, you know, their understanding of the discipline. In many ways, it can be sort of a literature review, but put into a context that, again, is focusing less on the academic community, but more on policymakers, the public, the media, and so forth. So, you know, it's another way in which, of course, rigor needs to be there, and, you know, things like you know, trying to build on high quality research when putting it into a CAST paper is critically important. I would want to mention that CAST is very engaged in these issues, is very, you know, interested in these topics. In fact, is you know, one of the things that they're putting together right now is a forthcoming publication on the social and economic impacts of misinformation in agriculture. So again, trying to communicate this to a broader public about the importance of rigor and replicability. And while I believe that is still in the process of being developed, would very much be building upon many of the tenets and pillars that have been discussed today. So thanks again for giving me a chance to talk, and you know, happy to answer questions.
Great, thank you. So let's see if there's you know, two or three quick questions for Dr. Stover, Dr. Messer, and then we can go into the open discussion phase. We are able to stay on the line past 3 o'clock, so there's not a hard stop at 3. But let's first of all see if there's any questions for our last two speakers.
And at this time, we do not have any questions waiting.
Okay, great. Excuse me. So let's dive into this as the open discussion period. And I think for the sake of time, I'd like to tackle three basic questions and sort of say the last one, what are the affirmative next steps for last? For later in the discussion. But let's open it up now, and I think if we could hear from the journals and societies, of, first of all, if there's any best practices that that they believe that their journals or societies are taking with regard to rigor and reproducibility that we haven't touched on yet. Secondly, if individuals want to speak about whether or not they do believe a consensus set of principles is achievable, and whether or not maybe leveraging what perhaps either the transparency and openness promotion guidelines or the principles and guidelines for reporting preclinical research that we heard about. I think certainly Denny Beer made the argument that a consensus set of principles should be reachable, but let's see if there's any discussion on that. And then I think going back to the topic of journals and scientific societies and whether or not they're willing to publish null results. This seems to be really a tough question. I know in talking to some other editors, you know, the bias of reviewers in publishing that. I think certainly the registered reports that Brian talked about certainly provides an avenue down that roadblock. But, you know, getting some perspectives from the societies and journals on whether or not they're willing to publish null results. So let's open it up now for open discussion and comments on those three, and then we'll circle back to perhaps the very end with closing comments on affirmative next steps.
Yeah, this is Denny Beer again. I'm not trying to occupy the discussion, by the way, so cut me off anytime you want. The issue of negative studies, I love negative studies. Why? Because everything else is positive, overwhelmingly, you know, impossibly positive. So if we get good negative studies, we're going to pay a lot of attention to them. But to me, there are two conditions for getting a negative study published. The first is that the question has to be important enough that we want to know that the answer is negative. There are all kinds of questions we don't really care whether it's positive or negative. They're so trivial, you know, that we don't deal with them. The second is that the study has to have enough power to feel confident about the negative result. We get all kinds of papers where there's just not enough power to know whether, you know, this is a negative result by chance alone. So, you know, I would say that if anything, you know, if you've got good negative studies in nutrition, send them to us because I'm really interested in them. The other, you know, perhaps controversial comment, and the opening said that I said somewhere before that I think we can reach consensus. By the way, I hope and I really do think we can reach consensus, but if we're just talking about reaching consensus within the USDA, I think we have a captive audience, so to speak, with a number of bosses who can write the rules that say that, you know, if you want to be a USDA scientist and publish, these are the rules. So I think we ought to be able to reach consensus somewhat more quickly, at least within one organization. That could be an example for others.
Yeah, hello, this is Hia Kieber, Editor-in-Chief of PLOS ONE. As you maybe know, we do publish negative studies, and we generally are very much in favor of a lot of these initiatives that have been discussed here today. I found it really exciting and interesting to see that this extends into this area. One of the things that we also at PLOS are doing is we have a pretty strong data policy in place where we ask for data to be deposited ahead of publication. That works most of the time. There's always slight hiccups here and there. One of the things I think where we can do a bit more to encourage data sharing is to make it a bit more, create more incentives for researchers to do so. So there needs to be more done on a journal level with data citations, citing data that is deposited, giving researchers credit for sharing this data in the same way as credit is assigned to papers by citing them. So the same could be done for data. One of the things where there's a bit of a limit for publishers, though, is what we can do is we can sort of encourage data sharing of the data that's reported in the paper. But usually a study that's conducted has a larger body of data that comes out of it. And I think that's where I think the funders also have to play a bit of a role, and maybe we as journals, or at least speaking for PLOS, we can work a bit more along these lines, that this larger body of data that is coming out of the study actually does get deposited, and not just the things that are reported in a particular paper. But anyway, all the things that are on the list, I find it very exciting, and we're certainly very happy to work with you and others on achieving these kind of targets. Thanks.
Do we have any more questions or comments in terms of best practices, development of consensus guidelines or principles, and journals, science societies willing to publish null results? Okay, so let's go on, I think, to sort of the last question, and hopefully there won't be dead silence on the air for this one, but really, what are the affirmative next steps that journals and scientific societies are willing to take to foster rigor and reproducibility in the agriculture, forestry, and nutrition research domain? I would hope that at the very least, we've got representation, we had registration from representation from over 60 journals and societies. So my hope at the very least is that each of you as representatives will go back to your leadership, to your boards, to your fellow editors, take back the information from this teleconference, provide them with links to the principles and guidelines if they're not aware of them, provide them with links to the Center for Open Science, let them know about the efforts underway at the National Ag Library, sort of the ambassadors back to educate them on this issue. And I also think the other key to take back to them is, the societies and journals don't need to reinvent the wheel. You know, we've heard about the transparency and openness promotion guidelines, as well as the principles and guidelines for reporting preclinical research. There are consensus documents out there that can be used as a template, perhaps right off the shelf, that have flexibility for your journals or societies to be endorsers. So any thoughts, and perhaps even CAST, with its role in issue papers, perhaps they might comment on a role for them for their organization going forward. But where can we go next?
So Doug, this is Mark McClellan speaking. Certainly on behalf of the Science Advisory Council of the NARI Board, we would hope and expect the Office of Chief Scientist to really engage now with giving guidance to both intramural and the NEPA extramural funding to step up and react to some of the discussion and points we've heard today. I assume this will be refined over time. Nobody's going to have this perfect. The important thing is that we start.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. That point is well taken, and certainly not only are the USDA agencies have been provided with a copy of the NARI Board report, they're working on their response to how they're specifically going to address the recommendations, and certainly we will be working with the Office of the Chief Scientist. Will be engaged directly with the agencies in providing feedback on this call. We are going to also, just as a, so I don't forget, we are going to try to get an MP3 recording of this call and hopefully a written transcript that we will try to make publicly available on the USDA website. If we can do that, when we do it, I will provide a link to the registrants. That may be then be a vehicle for you to go back to your editor boards and societies and share the information as well.
Doug, can I follow up with one point? Again, this is Mark. One of the concerns that the Advisory Council to the NARI Board had was that each of the societies really open up opportunities for true discussions with their faculty, with their principal investigators. We're very concerned that this not happen in a vacuum, not happen without some really serious engagement of membership. And we think that will be very pivotal in establishing a cultural change that will support what editors and editorial boards choose to do, so long as it's done in that greater conversation that involves members of the various societies.
Great, thank you. And I'd also like to emphasize that the USD Office of the Chief Scientist is an eager and willing partner. So if there are events that societies or journals are putting together and they'd like to hear about initiatives being undertaken, get briefings on the advisory board report, et cetera, we're happy to engage on those issues. I mean, I think if I had a take-home message for this call is that we're all in this together and we all have a vested interest, whether it's the scientists who are conducting the research and relying on the published research results to inform the directions of the research, whether it's the funding agencies that support the research, whether or not it's the regulatory agencies that rely on the research, and then the societies and the publishers that put out this research and also rely on this research. We're all in this together, and I think, as the NARI board report, you know, emphasized, that it's going to take all of us in the scientific community to work on this issue if we're going to move forward on it. Any other comments or questions before we wrap up? All right, well, if we don't have any more questions or comments, again, I would like to thank you. From our perspective, we see this as just the initial step in opening up this engagement. As Paul Wester had indicated, NAL has efforts underway. Those efforts are ongoing and will continue. We're, again, eager and willing to partner on this issue. And I think what our plans are, if the participants are willing to go back to their boards and societies, talk about, you know, brief your groups on this call, we can circle back perhaps in 2-3 months from now, see if there's interest in having a follow-up call, a workshop, putting together a working group to move forward. But we really view this as just the initial step to get the topic off among the agriculture, forestry, and nutrition research domain. So thank you, everyone, and I look forward to continuing this dialogue going forward.